Flux FM Spreeblick.
Pop, Politik, Positionen.
Zu Gast bei Flux FM Spreeblick mit Johnny Häusler, New Model Army Frontmann Justin Sullivan.
Flux FM Spreeblick, eure Lieblingssendung, jeden Sonntag zu hören von 10 bis 12, jeden Montag die Wiederholung ab 22 Uhr und danach dann alles nachzuhören im Internet. Und dieses hier ist eine Premiere, denn das wird die erste Flux FM Spreeblick Ausgabe, die komplett auf Englisch sein wird. Also ich werde nicht die ganze Zeit übersetzen, denn ich glaube, das würde den Gesprächsfluss ein bisschen stören. Denn zu Gast heute bei mir ist Justin Sullivan von New Model Army.
Bradford, England, Ende der 70er. Gitarrist und Sänger Justin Sullivan gründet zusammen mit dem Schlagzeuger Robert Heaton und dem Bassisten Stuart Merrow die Band New Model Army. Eigentlich wollten sie zusammen nur ein paar Konzerte spielen. Es sollten aber über 30 gemeinsame Jahre werden. Anfangs noch Sprachrohr der Arbeiterbewegung gegen das Establishment, gegen die eiserne Lady Margaret Thatcher. Heute mehr Folk als Punk. Für die Umwelt, gegen Globalisierung, gegen Kapitalismus. In die Charts haben sie es nie geschafft und trotzdem haben sie eine riesige Fangemeinde. New Model Army Frontmann Justin Sullivan ist heute zu Gast bei Flux FM Spreeblick und Johnny Häusler.
So welcome, Mr. Sullivan.
Hello.
How are you?
Bit tired, but okay.
You're on a promo tour for the new record, right?
Yes.
And I just told the listeners that this is the very first edition of this show, which I've been doing for 3 years now, on a weekly basis, which is going to be all in English. So, I suspect...
Kann nicht Deutsch sprechen.
Well, that's pretty good. So if you keep saying that, it's going to be okay. Now we're going to do it in English, and I don't think I can translate because there's so much stuff that's going to get lost. So I try to get along with my English, and I'm pretty sure yours is very good. As we know from the lyrics, we heard a song from the new record, Beginning, which is the opener of the new record. Tell us a little bit about the excitement of having a new record. Which one is it? How many records did you have before?
I don't know. I don't know how to count them exactly, because the last one was Between Wine and Blood, but that was kind of half a record after Between Dog and Wolf, which was a whole record, and you have to sort of add on the halves, and I don't know, it's 15 or something.
How many musicians did you have?
That must about have been the 15. Same number.
Yeah,
we had a sort of very organic change of musicians. Somebody new joins every 5 or 10 years, and it's very good for us. Because one new person in the band changes all the relationships within the band. Mm. And I can't imagine being in the same band with the same people for 30, 40 years. Because if you're with the same people all the time, you kind of avoid the areas of conflict after a while, which makes everything narrower and narrower and narrower. Whereas if you have someone new in the band, it opens everything up again and everything's suddenly open again. And so we have this kind of organic change every 5 or 10 years.
But that sounds very positive. It's also a problem, isn't it? Because you have to get used to, you know, I remember seeing that documentary, that brilliant documentary about your band. And there was, I don't know which bass player was it, but he said that it was really, really hard to, you know, get into trying to fit in the beginning.
Perhaps. I think that when Stuart left, that was a big shock because I started the band with Stuart. And when Stuart left, it was a big shock. And Stuart was an exceptional musician. And Moose was the only person we could find that could do a semblance of Stuart. Mm-hmm. But he probably wasn't the right guy. Whereas mostly we picked the right people. The last couple that have joined, I remember when Marshall joined in 2006, it was like, yep, he's the right guy. And then Kerry came in 2011 or 12, I think. And we were kind of unanimous. Yes, it's easy. The easy choice out of 60 people, it's Kerry.
What's the biggest age difference now in the band?
Kerry, when he joined, was 25. I mean, he's now 29. I'm 60, so 31 years. It's quite good to have someone really young, though. When we were auditioning bass players, we discovered that people under 40 couldn't really groove, and people over 40 weren't exciting. And when we played with Kerry, it was exciting. So obviously we chose that.
People under 40 weren't exciting.
No, yeah, people over 40 weren't exciting.
Oh, okay, well,
people under 40 couldn't groove.
Okay,
they were too edgy. But the edginess, we chose the edginess over the groove, of course.
Well, let's listen to some music and then we go on. Natürlich müssen wir ein bisschen Punkrock hören hier auch in dieser Show. Justin Sullivan von New Model Army ist zu Gast, die erste englischsprachige Ausgabe von Flux FM Spreeblick. And we just listened to one of the greatest Punkrock bands ever, The Ruts. In a Rut was the song.
Changed my life. This was the template in a way. I saw The Ruts in 1979 in a little pub in Bradford, 200 people. Went into the gig not really knowing what I was going to do with my life or what I wanted to do musically or anything. Came out of the gig knowing that if I could make one person feel the way I felt walking out of the gig, then my life would have been fulfilled. To feel the same as I felt walking out of the Ruts gig. It was like everything that was wonderful and scary and beautiful and exciting mm-hmm. and frightening about being alive just... They were the best band that I ever saw.
And they didn't play for that long.
No, about 6 months after that, he was dead.
Yeah, very sad story. I never saw them play live. With my bands, we played with them like a year ago or something with the Ruts DC, which is, they're still a great band, by the way.
Funnily enough, we haven't played with the Ruts DC. We've been very close to it a couple of times. I mean, there's, you know, maybe in the next year or two we will.
Really, really great live band, and they play a lot of reggae, and which they did way back then. Blah, blah, blah. But still a great band, but of course not the same as in the late 70s when there were still the Ruts. It's funny that it seems that everybody who got socialized with punk rock music has this one moment where it really clicked and it really changed his or her life.
There was two. There was that concert and hearing polystyrene talking on the radio, because there was this idea that punk was this entirely negative sort of anti thing. And I was already quite old. When punk rock happened, I was already in my 20s, so it wasn't a sort of rebellion teenager thing. And I was still a bit stuck in the hippie world. And it was polystyrene, that energy of hers, a kind of innocence, a kind of just an energy, really, and a spirit. And it was hearing her talk. That was the first moment that I get it.
What was she talking about?
I think she was just talking about punk and music and life. But the whole thing about punk is that there's this terrible thing which it came to mean playing guitars and shouting a lot. Which it wasn't in the, you know, it was all about, it was a cultural revolution which was designed to sweep away the conventions of how you were meant to make music or how you were meant to write poetry or how you were meant to do. It just swept everything away. It said that the spirit with which you do everything is much more important than the expertise. And it was a very liberating thing. And then in one branch, it got crystallized into this horrible, you've got to shout loud and shout and play guitars loudly. But the other way was to take the idea of it doesn't matter what you do, it's all about the spirit. And that went off into all the kind of post-punk experimentation, including, you know, sort of Joy Division, Kelly Joe, Susie's Banshees, us, blah, 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 all these bands. Who were just experimenting, having broken all the rules about what you had to do, you could do anything. And also all the poetry of the time and the beginning of the electronics thing, sort of the Human League, Depeche Mode, all the stuff that came from that. It was a kind of time of all the doors were blasted open. And it's terribly sad that it's come to mean a kind of very limited form of music. It wasn't that.
Well, maybe it's, looking back, I think there's probably three major definitions of what punk means or meant. One is just musically, what you said, you know, you have to scream and be loud, and then you have all those American rock bands that call themselves punk bands, which is just a genre, maybe. Then there's all those people who thought punk means, you know, getting drunk every day or being on drugs every day and just not caring about anything. And to me, it was always this do-it-yourself attitude, which was important to me. You know, you can do basically people telling you as a teenager, you can do whatever the fuck you want to do.
We were just talking a minute ago about the fact that all of us that grew up in that generation and were influenced by that time, we've got this instinct. When somebody says tells us what to do or advises us what to do, our first instinct is to go, nope.
Yeah, it's horrible. I know.
Sort of an instinct for resistance.
Are you still like that?
Yes.
Okay, me too. Okay, let's have some music. Oh, we're going to have the Temptations now. Papa Was a Rolling Stone. And you wanted to hear that song.
My first love. I never really liked rock music, funnily enough, although I'm in a rock band. My first love has always been Tamla Motown. And this is great, particularly James Jameson, Benny Benjamin, all the classic mid-60s Motown things. Although this is 1970, and this is a little bit later. There's this story about Norman Whitfield, was this kind of spotty little kid with glasses that used to sneak into the Motown studio and hide behind machines and stuff where no one knew he was there and watched everything. And he took in everything that was happening. And then the moment that came, I can't remember how he sort of rose through the ranks to become the producer of all these. And this is an ultimate sort of producer's song where he had a vision and made it happen. I think this is a masterpiece.
Justin Sullivan, zu Gast bei Flux FM Spreeblick, die erste komplett englischsprachige Ausgabe. I'm sorry, I didn't want to interrupt.
No, I interrupted you.
Okay.
I was saying, was that the short version? I mean, it does go on for 8 or 9 minutes.
Oh, no, we were just skipping it, basically. No. When the show is finished, we have to say that this is pre-recorded. When people at home listen to it, it's pre-recorded. So we still don't know who won the game, if Wales won. Basically, that's going to happen tonight. We can tell it. It's okay. We don't have to pretend. We still don't know if Germany has won the game. And so, I mean, this is going to be a Sunday. And I think it's that's the Sunday of the final. Ah. So we don't even know who's in the final at the time we're recording this. Are you watching it?
Yes.
And so you're watching Wales tonight, of course.
Of course.
Okay. Where were we? We just realized that people who grew up with punk rock in the late 70s, early 80s, that they are not very easy to advise, let's put it that way. And he said, you're still like that. I wonder of course you're not as, you know, as stubborn and arrogant as we were when we were 20 or 25 or 29 or 31 or whatever.
Stubborn, maybe not quite so arrogant.
When did you realize that, you know, advice can be good?
I think actually when we made The Ghost of Cain with Glyn Johns, Glyn Johns was a hard taskmaster, and I've talked to various artists that have been produced by Glyn Johns over the years. He was the kind of headmaster that you kind of fear but certainly respect. And he, do you want a story?
Of course.
But the first night we recorded with Glyn Johns, we were terribly excited because we thought, my God, we're working with Glyn Johns. We're going to sound like The Who. And so, you know, it's going to be great. And it was the mid-80s, which is the time of the producer does everything. You know, producer makes you sound amazing. So we went in and recorded something. And we came out and he pressed play and we listened. And my little heart sank. And it didn't. And then got to the end and he said, what do you think? And I said, I don't think it sounds very good, Glyn. And he said, no, it doesn't, does it? And I said, can you make it sound better? And he said, me? Me make it sound better? I'm recording you. This is what you sound like. If you want it to sound better, you have to learn to play. Which was very good advice, to be honest. And everything that we did after that, we took that, you know, we got serious about actually being musicians because we wanted to sound great. And he said, in order to sound great, you have to learn about what you're doing, which was, you know, and it was the album after that, Thunder and Consolation, that was, you know, very successful and stuff. So, yeah, you have to take advice sometimes.
But sometimes it's that you realize afterwards, isn't it? Because at that time, I can imagine that when he said that to you,
I fought him every step of the way.
It must have been a hard time recording that.
He hated me and I hated him, since when we've become very good friends.
There's rumors of him kicking you out of the studio way back then.
He did kick me out of the studio, I think, a few times. There was one time we were recording and we were arguing and he said, I'm sick of you, Justin. Come with me. And I followed him into his house, which we didn't normally go into. It was behind the barn where we were working, in his studio barn. And I went into the house and walked along the corridor. He said, "What do you see?" And I said, "I see your gold records, Glyn." And he said, "Yes. Now, where the fuck are yours? Should we go back to work?" And many years later, Thunder and Constellation was very successful. I wrote to him. I said, "Dear Glyn, you remember when you asked me where my gold records were? I just went and I've now got one. Love, Justin." And he wrote back. He said, "Dear Justin, well done. Not before time, Glyn."
So but now you're friends.
Mm.
He did such an amazing amount of great records.
His son actually has followed in the same footsteps. If
really?
You look at the way Ethan Johns produces, and the really great records that Ethan Johns produces, all of these are the same. It's very naturalistic.
Mm-hmm.
You just take the instrument, you put the right microphone in the right place in front of it, and then you don't mess with it. That's it.
Okay.
You record the sound. You know, and.
But that's an art.
It's absolutely an art.
Because it's horrible sometimes when you listen to something and you like an amp or whatever or drums and you think this sounds amazing and then somebody puts microphones on it and you hear it in the mixing room and you go it doesn't sound like that.
Exactly.
That's an art form.
Completely.
I didn't even know that his son is doing production as well.
Yeah, he's done a lot of successful records over the last 20 years. Yeah.
All right.
Well, and when we were making The Ghost of Cain, Ethan was age 13, was doing some of the edits on the tape.
Cool. Well, that's when, you know, when you're grown up.
Best Kings of Leon album was Ethan Johns.
Okay. I didn't know. See, I learned something in my own show, which is cool. We're going to listen to another song that you brought along, which is Gillian Welch, "The Devil Had a Hold of Me." Anything to add?
I was a bit surprised. I sort of... iPods have got that thing. You can say your most played artist...
Oh, okay.
It turned out to be Gillian Welch. I was slightly surprised, but actually, I think her and her partner Rawlins they're a brilliant, brilliant pairing. And it's this very simple. This is folk music, not the diddly 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 dee. You know, sort of basic stories told very simply and done very simply, just really well. Every time I've seen her, I've been absolutely spellbound.
Noch mehr Motown, mitgebracht, gewünscht, ausgesucht von Justin Sullivan von New Model Army, der hier zu Gast ist bei Flux FM Spreeblick, eine komplett englisch, ne, fast komplett englischsprachige Ausgabe. So, more Motown for you. I was in the beginning when people were talking about rhythm and blues, but in the last 10, 15 years, I was always expecting something to sound like a little bit of Motown, you know, 60s or
Everybody's
something.
Tried to copy it, but no one can quite do it.
What is it about it? I mean, yeah, it's the real instruments and all that.
It's the best musicians that ever existed, the best backing band ever. Mm. I think it was a time when the best musicians were playing, the best writers were writing, the best producers were producing, and the best singers were singing, which isn't so true now, perhaps. I think you can say that perhaps about Back to Black, the Amy Winehouse album, where he went and got, Ronson went and got the band mm-hmm. from New York mm-hmm. and the best musicians and recorded on tape and everything was done the right way, which is why it's so good. But most records are not done like that.
I also think, you know, for pop music, I think some of the stuff that Ronson does is still brilliant. I mean, it's great pop music and it's very, very well done.
I think Motown was also... had the spirit of the time, which is the mid-60s was a time when the idea was, the feeling generally was that things are going to get better for everyone. And, you know, it was a black business in a white industry, but it was it had this kind of upward momentum. Okay, Berry Gordy was a bit of a monster, but he did collect together a group of people. I don't think now it could probably ever happen in quite the same way.
Is it because things are not getting better? Or?
Partly. It's interesting. I picked Stone Love, which is... I'm not a great fan of happy music. I sort of...
Surprise.
I find happy music quite difficult. And yet this is probably the happiest song ever. You can play at my funeral. Everyone will be tapping their toes as they walk out, which would be cool.
But I listened to the new record only briefly twice, we're actually the first to have played a song from it, I think. So this is a world premiere or whatever you want to call it. But what was I going to say?
It's not a happy record.
It's not a happy record. It's an angry record. It's still dark, you know, as New Model Army are. So I always wondered, why isn't there more angry bands? Because there's, to me, there's so much stuff out there that you can be angry about. And I wonder, you know, there's loud music, there's aggressive music, but it's a different kind of aggressiveness, I think, than the one I like. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. I don't know. It's an instinct, I guess. But it's probably the angriest record we've made for a while. I mean, it's a mixture of what was happening around us a year ago and what was happening in our own lives, I think. And it's interesting that we finished the record in some of February, March, and then it was all written last year. And then the day after the referendum, I listened to it and I went, my God, you couldn't pick a better record for this moment. And I guess that makes sense because whatever anyone thinks about, you know, the referendum and the Brexit vote, if they were surprised, they haven't been paying attention.
Mm.
You know, this wasn't a surprise to me or a lot of people around me. I was very fearful of what was coming. I mean, the title track on the album, Winter, is there's the line at the end, I fear the age of consequence and I wish that it was over. You know, this kind of thing unraveling has been threatening to unravel for a while. I think now it's going to unravel, perhaps not in a very nice way. But it was never the status quo was never going to survive. It survived very artificially after 2008. I'm very frightened of what's coming. Actually,
we should talk a little bit more about Brexit and what's coming or what could be coming and what was happening to lead there. First, we're going to have some music, and then after the break, after the news, we're gonna listen to Winter. Okay, but first this year.
Flux FM Spreeblick.
Musiker, Macher, Meinungen.
Zu Gast bei Flux FM Spreeblick mit Johnny Häusler, New Model Army Frontmann Justin Sullivan.
Flux FM Spreeblick, eure Lieblingssendung jeden Sonntag von 10 bis 12, jeden Montag die Wiederholung ab 22 Uhr. Dann das Ganze als Podcast und im Internet ohne Musik dann leider zu hören. Mein Name ist Johnny Häusler und wir haben Justin Sullivan zu Gast von New Model Army und hören jetzt auch mal aus dem neuen Album Winter einen weiteren Song, nämlich den Titeltrack, über den wir gerade schon gesprochen haben.
Folk, Punk oder Alternative. Die Band New Model Army ist vor allem eins, Rock'n'Roll. In über 30 Jahren Bandgeschichte ist den Briten um Frontmann Justin Sullivan schon so ziemlich alles passiert. Einmal brannte das komplette Bandstudio ab, bei einem Konzert wurden fast alle Instrumente geklaut, bei einem anderen erlitt Sullivan einen Stromschlag inklusive Nahtoderfahrung und Wiederbelebung. Hunderte Konzerte, Soloprojekte und eine Fanbase, die sich The Family nennt. Justin Sullivan und New Model Army machen auch nach 3,5 Jahrzehnten unermüdlich weiter. Im August erscheint das mittlerweile 14. Studioalbum. Heute zu Gast bei Flux FM Spreeblick und Johnny Häusler, Justin Sullivan.
Bring Me the Winter, and in the info sheet for the record, somebody actually says winter is coming with that Game of Thrones reference. I guess it has nothing to do with that.
No, I've never seen it.
Oh, sorry, your mic's not. Yeah, no, we can hear you.
No, I've never seen the Game of Thrones, but I'm aware of it. Mm. But I didn't know this Winter is Coming thing was was there, and the song was written, you know, a year ago or more actually. But yes, I sort of know about the Game of Thrones without having really watched more than 5 minutes of it.
Okay,
but this sort of idea of Machiavellian politics and power plays is something that I am quite interested in. It. I mean, that is the world of politics. It's a dirty game. It always has been. It always will be.
It's a great series. I couldn't follow it anymore because I mixed up all the names. You know, I'm very bad at huge, like five different families with all those names, and I couldn't, you know, follow anymore who's dying and who did what to whom, and also it's in parts it's very, very brutal, which I was fed up with for a while because I was just fed up with seeing people die on television in a series that was there to entertain me. When this, I mean, I know this sounds a little cheesy, but
no, it sounds so many perfectly. That sounds perfectly sensible to me.
I was just sick of it because. And we were talking about Brexit a little bit. Did it surprise you?
No.
The result?
No.
Even though it was very close, so there's, I mean,
I thought it might be even bigger, the margin. There's a line in Eyes Get Used to the Darkness, which wasn't written about Brexit, but it's when no one listens much to what you say, then all you're going to say is no. Mm-hmm. And that's it. You have a sort of neocon experiment for 40 years. This idea of trickle-down economics, allow the super rich to get super rich and everybody will get rich. And the system's great and it works, and the market is good and it works. And 2008 should have been a wake-up call for everybody, but it wasn't. And everybody pretended that everything could go on. And this maybe is the first moment when you say to people, what do you think? And basically the answer comes back, fuck off.
Mm.
That's all it was. It wasn't anybody weighing up the pros and cons of staying in the EU.
Mm.
It was just a howl of rage. And it's very easy for, I'm a Remainer. I say it's very easy for all the things you criticise are not the fault of the EU, they're the fault of 40 years of Tory government combined with Blair. That's, analysis is not the thing of the moment.
Also, the whole EU thing, I think that even here and in other European countries, people would probably vote for exit. And it's not because they hate the idea of a European Union, but I think that the whole concept of having one government in Brussels, which is basically where it's leading to, has just never been explained. And, people just, when they're complaining about people governing Europe and they never heard of them, it's partly, you can hear of them. So you could blame people themselves. But, how much do you have to dig into politics to really understand the whole European system? And it was never explained. People have the impression that they didn't vote for those people, even if the people they voted for them. But it's just gotten so complex. I also think that most people just said, fuck off, I don't want that. It's probably just too big for me and I don't understand it. And then when people come along and tell you, well, we don't want any more immigrants.
I guess that's the fear, is that it's fueled by a kind of right-wing nationalistic thing, which is on the rise everywhere. It's the 1930s again. There's that Yeats poem, isn't there? The centre cannot hold on... But we put into place a system which is not sustainable. And one way or another, this system was going to come down. And maybe this is the first card in a house of cards coming down. I still think that there's something in that kind of little England Inselhofen mentality which I fear and loathe, to be honest. The sort of tribal wars... We should fear them. And okay, not having tribal wars means that a whole load of compromises. Perhaps that's better. Perhaps in Europe we've had like a long 70 years of peace or something. We've forgotten what war actually is. Maybe monkeys get bored. Perhaps we're bored of peace.
Mm.
You do get a sense of this sometimes.
I personally think there's wars going on. I mean, apart from the obvious ones, but even... I think that the wars are just very, very different. They're also partly online and,
The problem with the online world is that the idea is that the online world breaks open the monopoly of the main media into freedom of information. But actually what happens is the online world divides into special interest groups. I read from someone that they said they're really surprised that Leave won because everybody they knew and everything they read online was for Remain.
Mm.
And you're thinking, well, and I'm sure there's lots of other groups online that were just for Leave, and things get segregated into groups.
Mm. Yeah,
there is a natural tribal instinct. We are tribal monkeys. We do have this instinct. Mm. But we should have learned by now that extreme tribalism leads to... not good things.
Were you ever afraid of, because the New Model Army following the fans, they are kind of like a tribe, a very friendly tribe. I've been to a lot of gigs of New Model Army, and it's always so fascinating to see people and to also feel the power and the spirit and how much they if I say how much they love the band, but it's a different kind of love that you get at other bands. But have you ever been afraid that this could lead into a strange direction?
Yeah, I could see it. I remember playing a big gig, probably in Germany, somewhere in the early 90s, when perhaps we were at our biggest. And there were 6,000 people going, "Hey, hey, hey, hey." And I looked at it and I thought, you know what, I'm not that comfortable with this.
Mm.
And we never became a big band. Maybe that was the reason, is that we weren't very comfortable with that mass making the audience into one animal.
Mm.
I don't think of the audience as one animal. I talk to a lot of other singers in bands and they always talk about the audience as if it's one thing and that you should unite the audience. I don't. I'm aware that part of our audience want to unite with each other and they want to create a kind of ritual around the band. So if they want to do that, that's fine by us. But we're also aware that there's lots of other people in the room that don't want to join in with this, and they and that's fine by us too. And we address them as much as we address the that other core. I like gigs of less than 2,000 people when you can see the eyes of more or less everyone. And I think audiences aren't one thing. I think they're all made up of individuals with different backstories and different needs from the music and different favorite songs and different outlook. And some people want to do the mass thing. Okay, if they want to do the mass thing, okay. And other people don't want to do the mass thing. That's very much okay too.
Well, and you never feed as a band. You never feed it. You know, of course, there's, you know, sometimes
everybody say yeah,
yeah,
no,
exactly.
Everybody clap, no,
exactly.
No,
you we're don't never going to do that. And you know, so there might be the occasional sound drop to have some singing along or stuff like that, because singing along is great and it's fun and it's just a great thing at gigs. But you never did the whole back and forth thing and the exactly what you said, clapping along thing. And that's probably why it still feels good.
I think it's the reason that we never became really big. I mean, in the early 90s, we were on the edge of being that kind of bigger band, and we kind of shot ourselves in the foot lots and lots and lots of times, so we didn't have to become that.
Yeah, maybe you did, but maybe in the end it was, I'm pretty sure that it was good for you, because
yeah, absolutely,
because you're still around, you still draw a lot of people.
Now we're in the position where we do what we want, in the way we mm-hmm. want, when we want, in the way, you know, it's complete freedom, and there's enough of an audience that you know, last time I looked in my fridge there was food in it, and there's enough to make mm-hmm. the next record.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were the how big we are, how popular, was never the point, never the guiding principle, and it still isn't.
Let's listen to some more music that you brought along. Amy Winehouse, Soul Music Again, Back to Black.
I love songs which are just simple stories, and you can immediately see all the pictures and identify with the character singing, telling the story. Like Jolene by Dolly mm-hmm. Parton, which mm-hmm. is the exercise in sort of perfect songwriting. Very minimal. I think there's only about 8 lines in that song, but you can see a whole story. And this is the same. There's a brilliant thing on YouTube of Amy Winehouse singing this on her own with just a mm-hmm. guy playing guitar. In a South by Southwest, but in a small bar, and it's spellbinding. And the kind of we were talking about anger earlier on, angry song.
Killing Joke, Exile, that was on your list as well.
It was. Yeah. I'm an admirer of Killing Joke, starting with that, you know, very, you know, in the wake of punk, break all the rules. Let's go back to really basics and do something which is just simple and hard and tribal. And that's kind of how they started. And then they, you know, they're actually really musical band. And they went through this phase in the middle with Love Like Blood and mm-hmm. Brighton the Thousand mm-hmm. Suns. This is actually a B-side. We wasn't even on Brighton the Thousand Suns, although I think it's a brilliant, brilliant song. I love that kind of... This is an album that sounds like it's made from the top of a mountain looking out on humanity, mm-hmm. Which I love that aspect of what they do. It's sort of slightly romanticized, but still violent. Sort of beauty and violence, that combination is something I've always been sort of drawn to in art. Recently Killing Joke made some good records, but they tend to be a little bit one-dimensional, I think. But still, I'm interested in everything they do. I think they're a really creative and really interesting band.
They're still playing as well.
Oh, yeah, 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 of course. Yeah. And every occasionally we've played with them, and I can't say I know them, but, you know, we've always got them fine.
I have to ask you about one band that I got to know when, at the time when Killing Joke, when I got to know Killing Joke, which was a band that only did a 10-inch record, which is called Basement 5. Can you remember
that? No, not really. I don't really remember.
Because I'm looking for that record. One of the songs was called Last White Christmas, and I think I found it online. There's a YouTube version of it or something.
You can find anything, yeah.
Almost. Well, in Germany, we have this special situation. If you try to, if you're having a German provider and you're trying to see some of the YouTube videos, they still haven't got along with the GEMA, which is, what is it in England?
I don't know. I have mixed feelings about that because I want to find the record that I want to find. Mm. But at the same time, I want to be paid for people playing, finding my records when I find, you know what I mean?
They just have to agree, I think. And it's a kind of, it's a long story. It's a boring story. It's lawyers, basically. So let's
But there is, you know, I don't know anyone that's under 25 that's ever bought a record or paid for a record. They don't see why they should. But at the same time, I'm thinking, hold on a minute. You want to hear this song, which could transform your life, and you won't pay 79 cents for it?
Well, they do now. With at least with streaming, but so it's like a, you know, modern radio station. And at least with my kids, they do go out and buy like this special box that they want if they really love an artist. So they go out and they probably don't buy the sound because they have that everywhere they go. But they buy whatever, the T-shirt, the box, the you know. The merchandise.
Yeah, I think it's quite good for us that we've always had Jules doing the art because, you know, buying a Malami record, you got all this lovely art as well.
And she also knew very, very much in the beginning, I think that it was, you know, partly heard that how important all that is for a band.
Very much so. She's completely part of the story.
Mm. So, but she's still doing the covers and everything?
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
So you're still like a huge bond between.
I think that's a fixed point.
Next, PJ Harvey. One line.
PJ Harvey sort of became a sort of cross somewhere between Kate Bush and something much harder. She's become one of those artists that I buy everything she does, whatever it is. Because I know I'm going to like something of it. And I think this is my favourite record. It's the most from the most commercial record in Stories of the City, Stories of the Sea, the most successful, most melodic, the most beautifully produced. And I'm sure it may not be her favourite or the, you know, but I just think it's a beautiful record.
Flux FM Spreeblick, eure Lieblingssendung. Heute mit Justin Sullivan von New Model Army, die erste fast komplett englischsprachige Ausgabe. And we've been talking about Brexit. We've been talking a little bit about the new record. Actually, we could do that some more. About changing musicians, about anger. I always have to think of that line, anger is an energy, by John Lydon. And I kind of miss it in a lot of music, I must admit. But maybe that's just because I'm old. Are you feeling old?
No, I'm still 12 in my head.
You're not.
You know, I'm 60 now, but you never feel that, do you?
What's the best and the worst thing about, you know, being older?
The best thing is you have learned that success doesn't mean anything, and neither does failure, that life does not divide into successes and failures. You learn that when you were successful, it didn't make everything all right, and when you failed, it wasn't the end of the world. Mm-hmm. I think that's what life teaches you. What's the worst thing? you just don't have the energy you once had. It's a different kind of energy, but it, you know, your body starts to get slower.
Yeah, slower, but still, you know, still strong. And we have e-cigarettes now.
So. Well, I'm a bit of a fan of e-cigarettes. I've been smoking since I was 14, and I would give up every now and again, especially as I got older. I found it harder and harder to breathe. You know, to start with, you run up to the top of the stairs and you're out of breath. And then it got to the point of singing a New Model Army song, and halfway through the line, I was run out of breath and I couldn't sing the line. And I thought, I've got to stop, except I love everything about smoking. except the way it makes me feel.
Mm.
And e-cigarettes to me were the finest invention of the 21st century. The moment I went to an e-cigarette, I could breathe. And it's 80% of the pleasure without the downside. I'm a big fan.
And you can smoke almost everywhere.
Yeah, if you're kind of careful.
You e-smoke almost everywhere. It was funny, there was a friend of ours who just recently said that, you know, the horrible pictures on cigarette packs they have now, you know, of diseases and body organs being, well, you know what I'm talking about. And she said, it's a bit like Brexit. One day we're going to wake up and we're going to have, you know, some bad disease. And then we're going to say, well, I didn't know it was that bad for me to smoke. And people are going to say, we told you all the time. It was on the packs.
I quite like that analogy.
I like that analogy a lot. Very funny. We're going to listen to The Who. Did you really ever wanted to sound like The Who? When you told the story?
But no one ever sounded like The Who. No, there's no copies of The Who. No one ever got close, because they're so early punks in the sense that they jumbled it all up. I remember seeing an interview with them, and they said, "Well, kind of the Keith Moon was kind of the lead guitar player, John Entwistle was kind of the drummer." You know what I mean? It was sort of they jumbled up how you make music. Quadrophenia, I think, is my favorite rock album of all time, because it's got this kind of amazing energy of their rhythm section. And all the violence of the time, plus you know the performance of Entwistle and Keith Moon, combined with lovely melodic guitar playing and all this orchestration, I think it's the best and perhaps the only example of an orchestra and a rock band really working together. Even though it wasn't an orchestra, actually it was all mellotrons, but it's sort of got this combination of beauty and violence that I talked about earlier. And if you did it now, people would use computers, and then it would not be the way it is. You could never make this album again, you know, or they even, you know, no one will ever make an album that sounds like this again, ever.
The Real Me, The Who. Wir sind fast am Ende dieser Ausgabe von Flux FM Spreeblick mit Justin Sullivan von New Model Army, der uns jetzt noch ein bisschen was über französische Musik erzählen wird. We're going to talk about French rock music. I haven't got a clue about it.
French music is very rich. It's lots and lots of different things. There aren't that many great rock bands, but one of the greatest rock bands that ever strode the world was Noir Désir. They never played that much outside France. I think they did South America and places like that, but they're mostly singing in French, and they weren't that bothered. They were so huge in France, they kind of didn't need to. They started like us in that sort of post-punk era. They were the most. We've played with them several times in the 80s, early 90s. They were the most dangerous band that I've ever seen.
Really,
the most exciting and dangerous. But then, of course, the singer Bertrand Cantat turned out to be dangerous in the sense that 10 years ago now he killed his girlfriend, who was a big French movie star, while she was shooting a film in Lithuania. He went to jail for, as far as her family and a lot of people in France are concerned, for not long enough. But he did his time in jail. And then the rest of the band waited for him. But when he came out, it didn't kind of work out. And he sort of laid low for a bit. He had more personal tragedies involving his ex-wife. And his story is a very dark and tragic story, obviously for him, but particularly for the victims along the way. He then formed a band with Pascal Humbert, who was in 16 Horsepower. He's French, but he came back and did this band called Détroit, which means straits in French.
Okay.
Which is where Detroit got its name from, the Straits. And there's to date, there's one album that they did. It's a wonderful album, actually.
So that's the
This is the closest on the album to Noir Désir, where it's kind of rock. Most of the rest of the album isn't really like that. It's much more considered, but it's a very dark album, as perhaps you'd expect. It is interesting, if you go to sort of parties in France, people will discuss Bertrand Cantat and what happened and everything, and Noir Désir, and everybody's kind of difficult place because obviously mm-hmm. he did a terrible thing. And yet he's a very compelling artist. I'm sure if he was American, he'd probably be the biggest star that ever walked the world because of the backstory. But I understand he's a pretty private guy, certainly now. And he was always a very extreme and dangerous performer to watch.
Okay.
Very compelling.
I read about the stories that you told, but I didn't know the connections.
Right.
So it's very interesting.
Well, the Detroit album's called Horizons. It's my favorite album of the last 2-3 years.
So what's next for you?
Next for us is going on tour with the record, which actually should be quite easy. Really looking forward to it because the winter record was a kind of reaction to the record we did before. We did two records, which were Between Dog and Wolf and Between Wine and Blood, which were constructed. We were tired of making bad sounding records and records that we hadn't really thought enough about the music, and they were badly mixed, and we thought we'll construct a perfect mm-hmm. record. We thought a lot about the structure of the music sonically, and then we went to one of the best mixers in the world, Joe Baresi, to mix it, and it was a sort of perfectly constructed temple. Having done that kind of 1.5 times, we thought, well, we've done that, let's now do the opposite. Mm-hmm. Let's make a completely unconstructed record, a record that's really played live in the studio. I try to get some of the band excitement of the band playing live. And we've always had this thing in Nimodlami that we like tom-tom rhythms. We like the upper end of the bass. We like the lower end of the electric guitar. And my voice is quite low, which means all this stuff is kind of colliding in the low mids, and upper bass. And in Dog and Wolf and Wine and Blood, we tried to kind of make space for everything mm-hmm. quite consciously. With this record, we went, let it be, let it all mm-hmm. fight down there. And it kind of worked out really well. We recorded on tape, which we've done for the last couple of albums. And tape gives this kind of brilliant, it makes the sound into sort of one. And we produced it in this kind of punk rock studio we discovered in Leeds where they're using tape. Produced, kind of co-produced with a couple of the young guys, Lee Smith, who mixed it, and Jamie Lockhart. And it's a punk rock studio in the sense there's all this old gear lying around and old instruments and stuff. The difference between it and every other punk rock studio I've ever been in is that everything works. It's like when you plug the lead in, it doesn't go, you know, everything's kind of clean and it sounds great. And they really understand what they're doing. And they made this record, which is it's kind of grungy. It's quite a violent sounding record, which is where we wanted to go.
And it sounds great.
It does sound great.
So go out, listen to it, buy it, or the other way around, buy it first, then listen to it. And you're going to be in Germany as well on the tour in, I think...
October.
And
then again in March, I think.
And you're going to play Berlin, the Huxleys, I think. Yeah. I think it's... Yeah. It's in October. So we're going to see each other there again. Thanks for dropping by, Justin.
Cheers.